The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about how a dinosaur is like a vacuum cleaner. Dave, how is a dinosaur like a vacuum cleaner?
Well, Rob, it has to do with the dinosaur's neck, and this story is all about how these very large dinosaurs, and there's two types in particular, one is known as Brachiosaurus, the other one is known as Apatosaurus, formerly known as Brontosaurus, for those of us who remember that old designation. But these were huge dinosaurs. These guys weighed in excess of 80 metric tons. They were longer than two semi-trailer trucks put together, and they also had really long necks. Brachiosaurus' neck was 9 meters long, which is about five times as long as the neck of a giraffe. And what they did with these necks is kind of like the action of an old-fashioned vacuum cleaner. Rob, do you remember those old vacuum cleaners where they had a really heavy body and they had that long sort of tube coming out of the body, and the body would just sort of stay in one place, but you could use the tube and the attachment to get into the corners and everything like that, and you really wouldn't move the body around that much. You were just moving that tube around a lot. Well, that's what researchers think was happening with these dinosaurs. And although it seems like a simple answer, this has actually been a very controversial question. Researchers kind of agree on why these dinosaurs were so big. These dinosaurs lived in a time where there was a lot of predation, so the larger you were, the more protected you were. And also, if you were bigger, you had a much larger stomach, which was important for digesting all the vegetable matter that these dinosaurs digested, and these dinosaurs were herbivores, not carnivores. But the size of the neck has been a real matter of dispute. Some researchers said they had these really long necks to reach up into the trees and grab vegetation, kind of like giraffes do. And others have said they actually use their necks to forage on the ground. And so in this new study, researchers used some mathematical calculations and, yes, some comparisons to classic vacuum cleaners to figure out exactly what was sort of the most energy efficient use of these necks. Because you imagine a creature that big, they've really got to conserve their energy.
Lifting their head up is not conserving energy.
Well, it's not so much the lifting the neck up and down that consumes energy. It's the tremendous energy needed to pump blood into the head. You're talking about pumping blood against gravity three stories high. That requires a tremendous amount of energy. So the question was that a good use of their energy, or did it make more sense for them to sort of forage on the ground where they wouldn't have to do that? And the researchers found that indeed it was a lot more energy efficient for these dinosaurs to forage on the ground. And this neck length of 9 meters was actually very ideal. If the neck was only 6 meters long, for example, it would have been less efficient. A 9-meter neck actually saves 80% more energy than a 6-meter neck because it can gather more food without the dinosaur having to move its massive body around. Again, think about these classic vacuum cleaners. The longer the dinosaur can stretch its neck, the less it has to move this gigantic body, and so it's not consuming as much energy. But beyond 9 meters, you actually start to lose the energy savings. So that was the first thing they discovered. All this sort of adds up to the idea that these dinosaurs probably spent a lot of time foraging on the ground. But the researchers say the dinosaur was actually saving so much energy that it actually could afford to also grab up into the trees as well. Even though that would have cost the dinosaur some energy for pumping all that blood, it would have been saving energy it would have otherwise spent moving its tremendous body around. So the dinosaur actually could have done both.
So an interesting modeling experiment. Are researchers using this kind of modeling for other purposes?
Well, we didn't really get into the article about what the applications are. We at Science Now like to say that dinosaurs are cool and just leave it at that.
Okay, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, while we're spending some time in the past, this next story is about prehistoric heaps of garbage and how they may have actually helped improve a modern ecosystem.
Which modern ecosystem are we talking about here?
Well, Rob, we're talking about the Florida Everglades, which are wetlands in Florida. And there's an interesting feature of the Everglades, which is that there's a bunch of these so-called tree islands. And these are basically patches of relatively high and dry ground that raise up about 1 to 2 meters higher than the surrounding landscape. And they cover about 100 acres. And what's most important is that they're hot spots of biodiversity. They host 2 to 3 times the number of species than the species living in the surrounding marsh. And they're really important, actually, habitats for animals like alligators and the Florida panther, especially during flood season. It gives these animals a higher elevation to escape to avoid the waters. And for a long time, scientists have just assumed, well, these mounds are sort of just like any other mound. You see, they're probably made from a little wrinkle in the underlying bedrock and nothing more to think about. But in this new study, researchers have a much more interesting hypothesis for how these mounds form. And they say that these mounds were actually started by prehistoric humans who were basically just throwing all their trash into a pile. And researchers call these trash piles middens. And these middens could have been composed of discarded food, charcoal, shell tools, even broken pottery. The prehistoric version of garbage. And what would happen over time is that these small garbage mounds would offer a foothold for trees, shrubs, and other vegetation, and that the bones in these trash piles would have been a really good source for phosphorus, which is a nutrient that's otherwise in very short supply in the Everglades. So basically what these researchers are saying is that these humans sort of planted the seed for these tree islands by discarding all their food in a pile, and then over time, these piles grew and grew until they ended up being the tree islands that they are today.
So did these researchers dig underneath these islands and find this trash? What's their evidence?
So what they did was they actually did go off to the Everglades and they dug down into these tree islands. And the researchers found when they dug down deep, they actually found a midden. So that was strong evidence that that could have been how some of these tree islands formed.
Is this a hypothesis for all of these tree islands, Dave?
Well, not everybody agrees, or at least not everybody agrees that this explains all of the tree islands. One of the researchers quoted in the article says his own analysis suggests that these tree islands actually started to form before people arrived. Even when there's middens, if you dig down deeper than the middens, there is still evidence of a tree island starting to form, but that formation was taking place before humans were even on the scene. So it's possible that humans may have helped the tree island grow by throwing trash into a pile, but in some cases there may have already been a mound to begin with.
But I'm guessing that the overall message here is not that we should just throw our trash wherever we please and say, oh, well, we're just starting a midden for trees to grow on someday.
No, it's a good point, Robin. In fact, while this does show that early human garbage was actually probably beneficial for ecology, or at least ecology in this area and biodiversity, our modern trash is not as benign as these old piles of food and carcasses and shells and broken pottery. Our modern trash is a lot more toxic to the environment. So I wouldn't advise anybody trying to create a trash midden in their backyard.
Okay, so last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, speaking of things you shouldn't throw away, this last story is about our electronic devices and specifically finding a way to charge them a lot faster than we do right now.
So battery technology, some advance there?
Exactly. The problem with modern batteries is twofold. First of all, it takes a long time to charge them, and it also takes a long time to discharge them. Now, if you think about charging, yeah, it's annoying when you've got to wait overnight for your cell phone to charge or your iPad or whatever. But think about some of the technologies that are coming up in the future, technologies like electric cars. The idea is that you would drive your electric car into perhaps a gas station that's actually an electric charging station, and you would charge your car. The problem is the amount of time it currently takes to charge these batteries, your car could be sitting there for hours, which is not very efficient if you just want to head to the grocery store. So if you had a quick charging battery, you could charge your car essentially as quickly as you fill up a tank of gas. And on the discharging angle, when we talk about things like solar power, one of the problems with solar power, it takes a long time to discharge this power from a solar fuel cell. So in other words, if solar power is maybe a backup for regular power and that regular power goes down, solar power can't take its place immediately because it takes a while for it to release that energy. But if you get it to release that energy a lot quicker, then the solar power could kick in and you wouldn't even notice that you had lost electricity. And so there's a lot of reasons we'd want batteries to charge and discharge a lot quicker than they do now.
So what's the innovation here?
Well, Rob, the chief innovation here is increasing the surface area within the battery. Part of the reason it takes batteries so long to charge and to discharge is because it takes a long time for the charge to actually move through the battery to get to where you want it to go. And so what the researchers did in this study was they designed this lattice within the battery that has a ton of nooks and crannies. And when it's filled with this charged storage material, the electrons in the material never have that far to go before reaching the battery's metal and then being conducted away. So the distance between your energy and where you want that energy to go is greatly reduced. And where the researchers tested out these batteries, they found that they charge and discharge up to 100 times faster than existing batteries do, and they held just as much, if not more, power than current batteries do.
So the question then, I guess, before we see these in our cars and cell phones and everything else, is how much can they scale up this technology?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And one of the advantages with this approach is that the approach the researchers used is already being used in industry today. It's actually part of the manufacturing process. So this wouldn't be hard to translate into manufacturing. And they do believe that this technology can be easily scaled up, although they haven't shown that yet. And that's going to be the next big hurdle, is to figuring out, can you scale this up to something the size of a laptop battery or even a large car battery?
How big is their battery now?
The battery now is about the size of a watch battery. So you can imagine that the applications for something that small are limited. So obviously they really do want to see if they can make this work in a much larger battery, although they say they're confident that they can do it.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about the smell of pain, figuring out exactly why some people lose their sense of smell. And it has to do with a receptor that also helps us feel pain, and also a story about creating sperm outside of the body and the implications that has for in vitro fertilization and artificial insemination. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we have a story about why the National Science Foundation is in hot water over U.S. science education. And we're continuing our very extensive coverage on the Japanese earthquake, the tsunami, and the aftermath, everything that's going on in that country. We are covering stories almost every day on that topic. We're also taking questions from readers and answering the most pressing questions our readers have. And you can find all of this on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.